I, first of all, have to say I feel at a slight disadvantage because I'm not an IP lawyer, I'm a public lawyer, so you will not only be hearing about IP in this session. But I was going to talk about the standardised packaging of tobacco and in the context of the UK case, the administrative law case. So I just thought I'd say something about the context, as this, I think the standardized packaging case provides a really useful vehicle to look at the relationship between health law, IP, and human rights. And the standardized packaging movement in the UK followed on after Australia was passed legislation, was the first place in the world to introduce plain packaging, or standardized packaging, as we usually refer to it here. But of course, this affects the commercial interests of the tobacco companies, who have reacted as one would expect. And so I just want to mention the context. I mean, tobacco, along with alcohol and issues related to obesity, are leading NCDs, and they're a leading, if not the leading, cause of preventable deaths. So it's a major challenge for social and economic development in the 21st century. And so there is considerable urgency about this issue. And then, as my title of my talk is about right to health, I just thought I'd mention something about right to health, because it's an interesting concept in that it brings together many of the things that we've been talking to today, the international level, the regional level, and the domestic level. So we saw it in the international law level. There are economic and social rights. They may not have the same enforceability as civil and political rights in international law, but they do protect health. And there's also the World Health Organization Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, and I'll say something a bit more about that in a moment. There's also regional law. The EU law is important in this field. In particular, Article 35 of the Charter, which says that everyone has the right of access to preventative health care. In relation to domestic UK law, well, of course, the UK famously has no written constitution or no codified constitution, and so we don't have any specific constitutional protections for the right to health, unlike, for example, countries like India or South Africa or Ireland. But we do have the European Convention on Human Rights, which is part of our domestic law through the Human Rights Act. But again, the ECHR has no specific provision to protect health law. It protects primarily civil and political rights, which are directly enforceable. However, the European Court, through its jurisprudence, has developed this idea of positive obligations, which again, Sarabi mentioned, the idea that there is an obligation to protect. And certainly the state may have a duty to act or take necessary steps to advance health rights. And this has been specifically referred to by the European Court of Human Rights in relation to Article 2, which is the right to life. And there is also a general state policy to promote good health. It's another aspect of health rights. It's not just treating bad health, but a positive action to promote good health. And in fact, it's very fashionable at the moment to talk about this idea of nudges. And these are some quotes taken from Cass Sunstein's book, The Ethics of Influence. And so the idea is that there should be state action to promote good health. So relying really on carrot rather than stick. So rather trying to persuade people to change their behavior rather than implement coercive measures, which might have ethical problems or conflict with dignity or other human rights values. So the idea of nudges is that we steer people in particular directions but allow them to go their own way. And of course that aspect is important in a country which values individual rights and autonomy, because choice is still retained. So it's there are no coercive measures here, so it's ethically acceptable. But at the same time, although we might be preserving freedom of choice for one group, for consumers, we may actually be mandating action from another group, from the producers. And of course, this is precisely what has happened in relation to tobacco companies. So measures aimed to reduce consumption of products considered harmful have included, you know, limitations on advertising, no use of vending machines, warnings, no sponsorship of sporting events. So a lot of limits, which of course affect their commercial interests and their ability to carry out their businesses the way they want. Now, I think we can't ignore the international aspect. And this is actually relatively new, because traditionally public health issues have been perceived as a policy issue for national governments. So it's only really, perhaps in the last 20 years, that this has changed. So it's increasingly become a global issue. And this is important because dealing with something like the power of tobacco companies, it's very difficult for a single state to challenge them. And the WH Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which came into force in February 2007, was the catalyst for a change to tobacco control. And both the UK and the EU are signatories to this convention. And it had an almost immediate effect. It spurred cooperative state action, for example, cross-border advertising and the illicit tobacco trade. It built an international consensus about social norms, that smoking was not acceptable, about scientific facts, that it's widely accepted that tobacco is bad for you, it will lead to your death, even secondary smoke is bad for you. And that also that public health imperatives were necessary, that action had to be taken. But the convention, although it does suggest that standardized packaging is one measure that could be taken, does not mandate that contracting states actually adopt these laws. So it's not a specific requirement of the convention, it's just a recommendation. So after considerable negotiations and discussion, the UK finally included a section in the Children and Families Act 2014, which gave the Secretary of State the power to introduce regulations if at some future time. And this included and the regulations may had were trying to reduce smoking for those under 18, which of course makes sense because it was a Children and Families Act. However, at the same time, if the regulation had a wider effect, that was also seen as acceptable. And the policy was set out, I've just set it out for you here, and it will be on the website so you can have a look. They were really quite detailed, encouraging people from starting to use tobacco, giving up using, trying to not let them start, reducing the appeal or attractiveness of tobacco products. It is widely accepted that the tobacco packets are really the last forum for advertising the brands and advertising tobacco. And it went on, so very detailed policy requirements. So then after a number of other reports, there were certainly a lot of reports and close consideration by bodies and parliament, we have the standardized packaging of tobacco regulations, which was the subject of the case that we're going to look at in a moment. And so this regulation was made pursuant to the Parent Act, Section 94 of the Children and Families Act. And also, it also purported to implement the EU Tobacco Products Directive. And of course, it's also worth remembering that the Tobacco Products Directive did not mandate or did not require states to introduce standardized packaging. So again, this regulation went beyond what was required by both the EU directive and the Framework Convention. And as you're probably all aware, the very detailed requirements were set out about how a packet of cigarettes should look, with only the health warnings changing. The font and maximum size of the text was specified, as was the colour, and the only colour that was allowed was Pantone 448C with a matte finish, which we now refer to as muddy brown. In Australia, they did studies with young people, and they found that this sort of drab olive green colour was the least attractive to young people. And so that was adopted. But then in Australia, they don't refer to it as olive anymore because the olive growers got very upset. So now we refer to it as muddy brown or Pantone 448 with a matte finish. And the regulations also purported not to affect trademarks, the registration of trademarks. So they said that this should not be an obstacle to the registration of the trademarks, and it should and it shouldn't give rise to a declaration of invalidity of a registered trademark. So attempts were made to specifically protect trademarks, and you've probably seen the pictures of or you've probably seen the gory new packages. So you can see that it's a muddy brown, not olive green. And the brand and variant has specific size. And it has this rather awful picture there. Again, studies from Australia, scientific studies, show that images apparently have more effect than just words. Sorry. Although I certainly know people who claim that it's going to encourage them to smoke, that it would be so cool to have something so ugly. But anyway, who knows? So the tobacco companies wasted no time in initiating a challenge because clearly there was a tension between public interest in protecting health and the safeguarding of their economic and commercial interests. And so we see the tobacco companies attempting to use human rights as a shield to protect their commercial interests. And they claim that their property rights had been violated, that there was a deprivation of property or a disproportionate control on the use of the property, and also that there was a lack of compensation. And so it raised issues under Article 1, Protocol 1 of the European Convention on Human Rights, Article 17 of the Charter, and also common law rights as well, because the right to property is also a protected common law right. And there was no argument at all about the fact that intellectual property rights would be considered possessions under Article 1, Protocol 1. But Article 1, Protocol 1, as we shall see, does give the state a wide power to interfere with rights to the public interest. So no one should be deprived of his possessions except in the public interest and subject to certain conditions. And then the second part is it does not impair the right of a state to enforce such rights as it deems necessary to control the use of property. And as we've seen earlier today, the content of Article 17 of the Charter is determined by reference to the European Convention on Human Rights. And the Court of Appeal, in this case, looked at at Article 17 and had no hesitation in saying that we accept that Article 17 protects IP rights, but the rights conferred on a trademark are negative rights. There is no creation of positive rights here. So Article 17 doesn't change the nature of the property right itself. So how does the European Court of Human Rights address issues under Article 1, Protocol 1? And because of the Human Rights Act, Section 3, Section 2, I think it is. Oh, sorry, I can't remember the section now. But anyway, one of the sections of the Human Rights Act requires the states to take account of the Strasbourg legislation. They don't have to follow it, but they do take account. So this case was referred to in the tobacco case, the Sprong and Sweden case. And so the first rule is that there's a peaceful enjoyment of property. And the second rule covers deprivation of possessions and subjects it to certain conditions. And the third, that states are entitled to control the use of property, although some compensation may be powerful. So these three rules are related. They're all linked. And the court does not always look at them separately. Sometimes they look at them as a composite. Sometimes they look just at one aspect. So the convention jurisprudence is not as clear, perhaps, as one might like. So here we definitely have possessions, but is it a deprivation or is it control of use? Now, a highly relevant factor in considering whether the interference amounts to deprivation is whether the legal title to the possession in question is retained. And here, the court had no doubt that indeed legal title was retained. And they also looked at whether or not it was a de facto expropriation. So even though the state claimed it wasn't depriving the tobacco companies, convention rights have to be, the rights protected have to be practical and effective. And so the court will look behind what is claimed to see what is the actual impact and whether or not these rights have been denied to the specific company. And the courts looked at a number of cases in relation to this issue. And the Pinnacle Meat Processors Company, which you've probably come across before, and this concerned sale of meat from the deboned head of cattle during the BSE crisis. And this was prohibited, and the company was forced out of business and, of course, lost their goodwill as well. But even so, even though this requirement, this regulation had a catastrophic effect on the company, it was still considered a control of use. And in the Ian Edgar case, there was a ban on firearms after the Dunblane massacre in Scotland. So this was a new policy, and again, unsurprisingly, this had a rather dramatic effect on a company which sold guns. But in spite of a major loss of business, this was still considered control and not deprivation. And finally, in the Eastside Cheese case, cheeses were prohibited for sale because they were thought to be unsafe. And so the court said, well, there's no transfer of property here. You're restraining the use of the property in the public interest. So it's a control of use, not a deprivation. So we can see that even though these companies might have suffered catastrophic economic losses, it was still not considered a deprivation of property. And so the court went on in this particular case and said a residual utility in these negative rights, coupled with the retention of legal title, means that it cannot be said that the tobacco companies have been deprived of their national marks. So the court said, well, they could still use their marks in order to stop counterfeiters or to advertise in trade magazines. And so it was still useful to some extent. So there was no formal deprivation. So again, they only sought to control their use. And then the court looked at, the Court of Appeal looked at whether an appropriate balance had been struck between the public interest and the private property interest. Now, here we have to some extent, look back to the earlier case of Justice Green, which was, I don't know if you've looked at it, but it's enormous. I mean, it's huge. It's like the biggest public law case I have ever seen. And he certainly did an amazing job going through all the evidence in great detail. And in fact, some of the tobacco companies decided that it wasn't even worthwhile appealing. But anyway, the one of the issues, the actual proportionality issue was not on appeal, but the Court of Appeal did uphold Mr. Justice Green's approach in the administrative court to proportionality. And accepted his conclusions on proportionality. So we were talking before about the fair balance and proportionality, and in fact the relationship between the two in this case is not so easy to discern, because Mr. Justice Green used his conclusions on proportionality to decide that a fair balance had been struck. So in a way he kind of collapsed the two together. And so he said proportionality may be lawfully expropriated or its use controlled if there is a, if it seems as a legitimate public interest or it's proportionate. Where a legitimate measure is categorized as a control, the fair balance will apply in determining compensation. So certainly the fair balance was relevant in looking at whether or not compensation, but the same reasoning was used in relation to proportionality. And in relation to proportionality, the overlap between fair balance and proportionality is very evident in administrative law generally. So if we look at like the leading case daily on proportionality in the UK, which has been cited on many occasions and approved in other cases more recently, the courts will look to see whether the objective is sufficiently important to justify the limitation of a fundamental right. Then they'll look whether it's rationally connected to the objective. In fact, the tobacco companies claim that this measure was not rationally connected to the objective because, in fact, it would not achieve the objective, because plain packaging would have the result of driving the price down, and then people would start to smoke the cheapest possible cigarettes. And so, in fact, they were likely to smoke more cigarettes than if there was no standardized packaging. The third issue the courts will look at is whether a less intrusive measure could have been used. And, of course, the tobacco companies claim that, in fact, other measures could have been used, for example, increase of taxation, greater controls on the use of children buying cigarettes, and control of where smoking could take place. And finally, the fourth one is whether having regard to these matters and to the severity of the consequences, the court goes on and says, has a fair balance been struck between the rights of the individuals and the interests of the community? So you can see that proportionality and fair balance in the administrative test tend to work together, although in Strasbourg, fair balance in relation to Article 1, Protocol 1 seems to have a different role. So I'd just like to say a few words about the common law. Property is also protected under the common law. It's considered a constitutional fundamental right, and so therefore, again, a higher standard of review would be appropriate if a deprivation was found. But in this particular case, the court said it was about control of use and not about the taking or destruction of property. All the two cases that were cited were both under the royal prerogative, in fact, the same cases that were discussed in the Miller case concerning the taking of property during wartime. But here, they said it was control of use, and that is not protected under the common law. So finally, I think we'll find that Article 1, Protocol 1, as a shield for tobacco companies, or as is likely to happen perhaps, further controls on alcohol, alcohol producers, food producers, these challenges are likely to be unsuccessful if there is control on the use of property rather than straight deprivation. The policy has adopted a legitimate aim, and we saw that in this particular case, the court went to great, or the legislature went to great detail to set out its policy aims, and also whether it's been subject to extensive parliamentary consideration and, for example, other independent reviews. In that case, I think that human rights is not going to act as a shield for in order to protect IP rights. Okay, thank you.